Welcome to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a Tail Eater podcast. This podcast applies a scientific viewpoint to the strange and bizarre phenomenon that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. In this episode, we hear a speech given by Jeremy Nearby, who is a Canadian anthropologist. Jeremy is the author of Cosmic Serpent and has an extensive background in South American shamanism and their use of ayahuasca. His book, Cosmic Serpent, explores ayahuasca and the origins of human existence. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about Jeremy and his books, please visit our website at taileaters.com/CEpodcast, and there you can also support the podcast through our patron page. Well, without further ado, let's get to the interview.
It's a great privilege for me, just to be here in my home office. It's a place where I've been doing all my thinking and reading and writing for the last 12 years, and to be able to be in touch, I'm leading this thing, but actually I've never really considered myself a leader and, more of an egalitarian and, I do my thing and everybody else does theirs and that's fine. But actually, the people that are out there participating in this course, it's just clear to me that there are many among you who know a lot more than I do about given subjects, and people who have more experience with ayahuasca or have done more diets or who sing more Icaros, and there's all kinds of know-how out there. For me, it's just a privilege to be here in touch with all you people, and then with those the guests that who will be coming. I'm looking forward myself to exploring the subjects with them, asking them questions, and learning. So it's a privilege to be able to launch this thing. The idea is to be able to talk about the subject of plants and shamanism and plants like ayahuasca, and using such plants in the modern world. What can we as moderns learn? Look at us with our modern technology here, having some glitches, but anyway. Having a planetary conversation with headphones and computer screens, what can people like us learn from indigenous cultures like the Indians in the Amazon? I've been thinking about that stuff, it's true, for I think about 25 years now. So I haven't got it all figured out, but I've got some ideas. And the idea here tonight is to start things by telling you just a little bit about my story and what I've experienced, and in so doing put a few things on the table. And then after that, I'll address some of the questions that were sent in, because there was an awful lot of good questions. So I'll just go right into it. I'm 51 now, but 26 years ago, I was 25. And that was in the middle of the 1980s, and it was a kind of a different world there. I mean, some of you were alive back then. Hallucinogens, LSD and mushrooms and so forth had been made illegal a good decade before that. People in the Western world weren't really interested in these things. The 1980s was all about cocaine and drum machines, and it was a different world then. I was just a doctoral student in anthropology heading to the Amazon to do some political economic research. The subject was about development and the World Banks and moving into areas with indigenous people, and it was all about resources and millions of dollars in development money and deforestation and stuff like that. Well, the truth is that when I arrived as a young graduate student in anthropology in the Peruvian Amazon in 1984, in fact, I did have some personal experience as a young Westerner with, smoking grass, eating psilocybin mushrooms, and also taking LSD. I mean, LSD is a product that is indigenous to Switzerland, and I grew up in Switzerland, so I'd actually had some experience with it. And so I thought I knew about these things, and by these things I'm talking about the modification of consciousness using psychoactive plants or substances. And arriving in the Peruvian Amazon in 1984, and I went to where Ashaninka Indians live, right in the middle of the Peruvian Amazon, in a place where the World Bank was building a penetration road into their territory. And these people were not only perfectly at ease in the rainforest and had deep knowledge of the plants in that forest and the animals and how to use them, of the biodiversity. This is actually the place in the world that has the greatest biodiversity. The forest there has just more species of plants, animals, amphibians, reptiles, birds, etc., than any other place in the world. And yet these rainforest people had names for just about every species in their own language. They had uses for, at least they ascribed uses to half the species of plants. When I would ask them how they had learned about plant properties, medicinal properties, or whatever they were saying about these plants, that's where I ran into the enigma of shamanic knowledge, because these people would tell me, well, the way that we learn about plants is that we take certain plants like ayahuasca or tobacco, and then in our visions we see their essences or spirits, which are sources of information, and these entities communicate with us and tell us about the plant properties. Well, as a young Westerner coming out of a doctoral program in anthropology at the University of Stanford, I didn't think that what they were saying was really real. I didn't take it seriously that they were actually getting verifiable knowledge from their hallucinations. It couldn't be true, because to consider that there's verifiable information in your hallucinations is the definition of psychosis. I mean, it was what they call an epistemological impossibility. So here we are looking at a Westerner coming out of the library and the suburbs and stumbling into the Amazon and running into head on into shamanic knowledge and not being able to make sense of it. They talked about plants as if they were living beings just like human beings, and that you could actually have conversations with them. And the way to do it was to, for example, there was ayahuasca, they said. And one man said to me one night, this is the television of the forest. And we take this plant mixture, and then we see images, and we learn things. I considered that I was experienced, as Jimi Hendrix put it, and that I'd taken LSD before, and I knew about this kind of thing. And it wasn't really, to cut a long story short, I tried the ayahuasca, and it was just it the my first ayahuasca experience with a young Ashaninka ayahuasquero, himself under Shipibo influence, and I'll get back to that. It was just something completely different from any of the tripping that I'd done in the Western world. I mean, first of all, these people seem to have a kind of a they knew how to orchestrate my visions. Through the way that the fellow was singing, it was just clear that he was impacting on what I was seeing. And I was astounded, first of all, by their level of know-how when it came to actually working with a modified state of consciousness. And what a modified state of consciousness it was. The quality of the experience was so different from LSD, for example. I think somebody has said, well, LSD makes me think, whereas ayahuasca makes me experience. And I think that there's something to that. I found myself plunged into a world of that beyond what I imagined, of enormous fluorescent serpents that were about 15 yards long, 1 yard high, and these entities started explaining things to me about myself that were difficult to. Well, difficult to deny, but also difficult to accept. They said, "You're just a human being, you know, a tiny human being." And as an anthropologist, I was studying human beings. I was a human being who was studying human beings. And what this experience, this plant mixture, and the combined with the singing of the shaman did was put me in front of my own presuppositions immediately. And well, it was kind of like an antidote to the anthropocentrism of anthropology, which is just what the young doctor ordered, as it were. This can be pretty culturally challenging. I found it very challenging. And at the same time, one can see right here one of the values of immersing oneself in another culture and another way of approaching knowledge is that it confronts you immediately with your own presuppositions. That's what I ran into with my first ayahuasca, approaching things and having that experience where it actually leads you to question what you yourself believe about the world. And, you know, why do we believe certain things about reality? Well, we've picked it up through our education and through our culture, and without even thinking about it. I think that the culture that that people carry around with them is kind of like the glasses through which you look out and look at the world. If you actually wear glasses, you know, it's the gaze that you have on the world. Most of the time, people don't really like to take off their glasses and you know, consider how they look at the world. But that's what this experience of going into a radically different place like the Amazon and approaching a knowledge and healing through this complete other medium. There's a question that comes up as to, well, how do Amazonian Indians perceive us? Well, once again, this can get into some pretty strange territory, but that's also what's interesting about it. It took me a while to figure out, as I was living with Ashaninka people, that they thought of me as some kind of vampire. Pishtakos, they say in their language. In other words, they conceive as white people as not necessarily coming from the same world as themselves, but coming from a kind of underworld, and that's why we're so pale. What they say about these Pishtakos is that they're actually interested in extracting the body fat of Indian women and children so that we can turn it into oil and fine oil, which we use to run our machines. Well, you know, the first time that I understood that these indigenous Amazonian people thought I was a vampire, I mean, I was a little horrified and at the same time kind of amused. But then I also realized how difficult it is to actually prove that you're not a vampire. I also saw that actually it was a pretty good metaphor for what European and North American people had done to them over the centuries. In other words, we'd always gone in there and extracted wealth and wood and gold and oil, and we're just thirsty for resources, and we are kind of resource vampires. So actually, their vision of white people as a whole bunch of vampires was a pretty correct metaphor if you look at it historically. It's not always easy to, you know, so when you actually go to the Amazon and you do run into indigenous Amazonian people, and they do have this understanding of you, it's not necessarily easy to be there and to consider that this is how they see you. But I mean, you know, we've inherited the history that our ancestors made, and we've just got to live with it. A particular time when I was with my main Ashaninka consultant, and we went to see his shaman teacher. He was an old Ashaninka man who was so old that he didn't even know his age, because he was born before the Ashaninkas learned how to count. And but by looking at the lines on his face, it was pretty clear that he was about 80 years old, this old guy. And so I was introduced to him, and he started pulling my leg and asking me if I was his father-in-law. And he did this about 20 times in a row. And actually, I learned later that what he was saying was, "May I have sexual access to your daughters?" But you know, I didn't understand the joke, and so he kept on just asking me whether I was his father-in-law. Konki, Konki, and I could see that he'd been taking generous portions of tobacco paste out of his gourd. This guy was an old tobacco shaman, and so anyhow, to cut his questioning me about whether I was his father-in-law short, I asked him if I could have some of his tobacco paste. And so he gave me his gourd, and I took some. It's this kind of a thick syrupy stuff, and you put a stick in it, and then you take some of the tobacco paste and put it in your mouth. And so I did this, and then let my main informant get on in his conversation with the old man, and I was just sitting there, as in, you know, sometimes as when you're doing anthropology in the rainforest, you just sit there and say nothing for a while and let the people do their stuff. So I'd been sitting down for about 10 minutes, and then I started feeling my teeth with my tongue, and it felt like my teeth had gotten a lot sharper. And there was this kind of taste of blood in my mouth. And even though I was a vegetarian at the time, it kind of tasted good. And meanwhile, I had the feeling that I had like these whiskers that were starting to come out of my face. And, you know, I hadn't shaved for a couple of days, but still it kind of... And then the next thing I knew, I was looking at these chickens that were clucking around, and I was gradually being overcome by the feeling of being a feline. And this tobacco paste was getting me to be inside the skin of a kind of a jaguar. And there was something exhilarating, and my body felt warm and powerful, just like a big cat. And at the same time, this wasn't even something that I believed possible. That experience of actually feeling like a jaguar in broad daylight for a good half hour, I mean, I both knew that I wasn't a jaguar, but it was still a fairly impressive experience. That feeling of actually being feline has stayed with me since. I can refer back to it like a very strong memory. And being able to actually think of oneself as an animal, I found a very powerful and enriching experience, if only as a way of getting back inside my body and accepting the fact that I am an animal, quite simply, and that there's no shame about it. In fact, there's a pretty impressive power about it. Yeah, and this is the kind of stuff. When one goes through these experiences, there are some tips that anthropologists have picked up along the way because they've done a lot of thinking. I mean, there's one guy called Claude Lévi-Strauss, and his way of making sense, or one of the ways that he made sense of how indigenous people talk about knowledge, is that they put it in myths. So he talked about indigenous mythologies around the world, and his point was that in the indigenous point of view, animals are not only good to eat, they're also good to think. Well, that's a kind of a pretty French statement, you know, animals are good to think. But I think that thinking like a jaguar is interesting, and it's you can learn things. And so they are good to think. And more broadly, I think that all this stuff is good to think. Allowing oneself to entertain thoughts that are kind of outside of one's own culture is interesting and enriching. It's not always easy. But, there's been some statements about, yes, ayahuasca fuels activism. It's true that I was a bit of an activist before I went to the Amazon, and then coming out of the Amazon, I became a professional activist, and that's been, I don't know, 21 years now that I've been employed to be an activist in favor of indigenous Amazonian people for a small Swiss NGO. I think that having experiences with the shamanic world, with the world of ayahuasca and tobacco, made me understand that there was more to reality than my eyes showed me normally, that there was a world inside the rainforest, in the plants and animals there, that was teeming with intelligence and intention, that it wasn't just a bunch of vegetables or plants or, you know, resources, that it was actually a living world. And that the indigenous people who'd been living there for many years had a deep and intimate knowledge about it that somehow contradicted some of our own cultural presuppositions, but was just too interesting to ignore. I think that ayahuasca can amplify things. It's even a kind of a non-specific amplifier, so it's not going to turn everybody into activists, but it certainly didn't hinder my activism and probably did amplify it. But the main motivation behind becoming an activist, really, I remember from getting back from the Amazon after a couple years back to the Western world, is that the Western world deconsidered these people so much, whereas my experience with them was that they were just wonderful people just like you and me, and that it was a shame for us to be bulldozing their forest and calling them prehistoric obstacles to progress, whereas in fact they were valid people and they had something to contribute. And that was the thing that really pushed me to try to do something about it. But what I've learned is, so here we are looking at what we can learn from indigenous people, but the question has also been asked is, what can we do for them? And it's about time that we start asking that question, because if you look at the last 500 years, it hasn't been very brilliant. It's been all about what Euro-Americans can take from the rest of the world, how we can dominate them and submit them and extract their wealth. But so now we're starting to ask the question of reciprocity. That's obviously a good thing, but the fact is that helping people is difficult, and I actually think the name of the game is to help people help themselves, because otherwise you just make them dependent. But even that is a fine art. It takes time to. I think that, for example, for well, a person like myself to go into the Peruvian Amazon and actually be able to be useful to the indigenous people there, it took at least 2 years just figuring out how they understand things, how they approach things, and how they speak. And then it's a question of letting them take the lead and listening to them. And asking them how one could be useful to them. And what I was told was that I would be most useful not in Peru, but back in my country, and trying to make them understandable here and trying to get support for their initiatives. So, it's actually almost like a full-time job of to really be able to be useful to people. And I think that even if so one if one has good intentions, one has never been to the Amazon, one says, okay, I'll be interested in learning about ayahuasca, but at the same time I'd like to be reciprocal and I'd like to help the indigenous people with their struggle. So it's actually difficult to be useful to them, but I think that one can start, and this is, I think, also what this course is about. One can start simply by learning with respect. I think that actually, finally, to have Europeans and North Americans who go towards indigenous cultures and indigenous people saying, "I would like to learn from you and with you." This is really a progress compared to what we've seen in the last 500 years of history. So, I think that just being willing to learn from them in some ways reverses history. Another thing that, making them kind of guardians of the past, as it were. By putting them into that kind of romantic role, it also kind of excludes them from being in the dynamic process of history. And they're not just victims of the last 500 years. They're also people who are busy resisting, and they've been living the birth of the industrial world and then how it descended on the Amazon. They've been participating in the history we've all been participating in. And I think just recognizing that history and what has gone on with the conquistadors and then the missionaries and now the gold diggers and the petroleum companies and the anthropologists and now the tourists, I mean this whole world, it's part of their reality just as much as it's part of ours. I think that well, history is important in general, but in particular when one is looking at complex situations like this. And that's something that Francis Huxley and I tried to show in our book, Shamans Through Time, is if you don't take a historical perspective on such subjects, it's really difficult to understand what's going on. And when you do take a historical perspective, suddenly things become a bit more clear. What's become clear about the relationship between, let's say, the Western world and shamanism is that it's been a difficult relationship, and for centuries, Westerners had a hard time coming to actually understand the subject and actually tended to project their own preoccupations onto it. Yeah, that's why it's important to there's a subtext to all this is that if you want to go into this whole area, it's worth reading up, reading books. Acting in the world is important. Working with plants is important, and reading books is also important. Well, and then there's websites as well, but still a lot of important information, I think, is contained in books. So, hooray for books, hooray for books. There's the question as to what indigenous people aspire to now. Well, first of all, who am I to, speak for them? But still, what I've understood from different indigenous people about, I think that it's pretty clear that one thing that I've heard no indigenous people complaining because suddenly there was interest from Europeans and North Americans in their way of knowing the world.
If you enjoyed this episode of Cosmic Echo and would like to learn more about Jeremy Narby and his work on shamanism and ayahuasca, you can visit our website at taileaters.com/CE podcast and find links there. You can also support our podcast through our Patreon page located at the same website. We look forward to bringing you additional episodes in the near future, and until then, happy dreaming.